stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with director Russ Trace, who is here for the fourth time directing for the Florida Studio Theater Productions, this time a cabaret production called Urban Cowboy. Listen to Russ's interesting dilemma and how he resolves it, and learn about the production, which is the very first to appear in the brand new cabaret space at Florida Studio Theater. So hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about living the very best life that it is possible for you to live. If you've been listening to the show, you know that I believe that our childhoods, that is, our experiences in our family of origin, our experiences with our peers when we are quite young, or school, or religious organizations, or the culture that we are born into, have a dimming and discouraging effect. Well, let me amend that. May have. Well, maybe I'll amend it again. For most of us, they have a dimming or discouraging effect on some aspect of who we naturally are. We are naturally gregarious and boisterous, but we live in a family that thinks that outbursts of expression, spirit, joy, delight, annoyance, anger, any of that, is anything from unattractive to the devil's work. And so we have our spontaneous response, which is natural to us and actually natural to most children. And the parents that we have, or the older siblings that we have who have already been discouraged, or the teachers that we have, or the neighbors that we have, come down on us and let us know in any number of ways. And here the possibilities are, you know, extraordinarily large. I mean, there can be the very simple don't do that, or there can be the raising of the eyebrows or the rolling of the eyes. I have one client whose name, I'm not going to use her name, so her name is Susie. Her family managed to control her by saying, "Susie, don't." And this "Susie, don't" had the effect of chilling the water in her veins. She knew immediately from the tone of the "Susie," and from the word, of course, "don't," that she had transgressed, that she had done something wrong, that she was a bad girl. And that's all it took to keep this little girl in line. Now, that's debilitating enough, and Susie's still struggling with that as an adult, because every time she wants to do one of these behaviors, which were natural to her and which actually she could use in her adult life, her mind flashes "Susie, don't." It's a flash. It's just a flash. She isn't even consciously aware that in the back of her mind she's heard the words and seen the expression on the face of the person who's saying it, but it chills her to this day and stops her from behaviors which she would naturally do, which would be expressions of her real self. And that learning that we do as little children, that doesn't go away. I am fond of saying to clients, maybe I should say here, for those of you who may not have heard the show before, that I am a psychotherapist. I practice these days entirely on the telephone. My whole practice is on the telephone. Maybe this is a time to interrupt myself tell you that you can find me and everything about me on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne, don't leave the E out of Lynn, show, thelynnshow.com. As I started to say, I tell my clients when they ask me, when is this going to be over, when am I never going to do this again, when am I going to be done with this behavior or these feelings, I always tell them that none of us is ever going to be someone who didn't have our history. Our history lives inside us. I know that when I say this, you know that it's the truth. We cannot amputate our history. Susie is never going to be somebody whose family didn't say, "Susie, don't." That's not going to happen. We can't take that away or exorcise it. If you are one of the unfortunate people who had an alcoholic for a parent, or a parent who was sick, or came from a divorced family, or had a parent go off to war and either not come home at all or come home with those terrible memories from war, that's not going away. And all of the things that you learned, like Susie, live inside of us. Those things stay there, and they continue to influence what we can and what we cannot do. So that later in life, if, like all the people who come to see me, there's something you want to do, some behavior you'd like to initiate. I mean, maybe, like Susie, you want to be a little more spontaneous. You don't want to have to think of everything before you say it. You don't want to have that terrible feeling of in the pit of your stomach when you think maybe you said something wrong or maybe you embarrassed yourself. So many people are stuck with that one. And that's not, as I said, going to go away. So suppose in your later life, you don't want to have that anymore, and you come into a therapist and you say, you know, I want to be more seat of the pants, right? I don't want to be thinking about everything always. So that is possible. It is possible to alter the behavior, because that, the ability to be spontaneous, which you had as a child, is your birthright. It is a part of who you were meant to be, who the best you is. And the Lin Show is all about making the point that it is possible to recover that early behavior, the early ways of being. But at the same time as it is possible to do, it's not easy to do. It's, as I have said now several times in this show, the flash that interrupts our behavior is unconscious. It's quite subtle, very quick, and we are not really aware of it. So there are skills that you can use to interrupt that behavior. If you are interested in learning some of those skills, you can. There are a number of things that you can do. You can go into therapy. That's what therapy is about. You can even come into therapy with me, and it doesn't matter if you live in Detroit or in London, because I'm at the end of the telephone. So if that is of interest to you, go up on my website, The Lin Show, T-H-E, The Lin, L-Y-N-N-E, S-H-O-W, thelinshow.com. Click on the icon that says contact me or email me and simply write, I want to talk about therapy. If you're interested in talking, doing therapy on the telephone, but you have never heard of it before, there's an article on the website called Psychotherapy on the Go in which I talk about what it's like. And if you don't want to hear about it from me first, but you want to read about it first, you can read about it on the website. If you are curious about the ways in which we become who we are and why it is so difficult to recover those aspects of ourselves, you can read my book, which is also up there. The book is called When You Can, You Will. Why you can't always do what you want to do and what to do about it. You can listen to the first chapter of the book. There's an audiobook up there, or you can order the book, or the workbook, or the audiobook. And you can also listen to all of the interviews. I think I'm working on my 245th as we speak, that I have done in the shows. What are the interviews? Well, to make the point that living the life you were meant to live is really good. It's really something you would want, something you would enjoy, benefit from. I interview people who do it. The people I interview are all people who make their living or their life with an art. And I interview these people because making a living with an art in our culture is so difficult. It's so difficult to survive that the people who do it because it is who they really are. And you hear it over, you hear them say it over and over again. This is what I do. This is all I could do. If you were listening last week to Kevin Morrow, he said, I have to do this. There's nothing else I can do. Kevin's an actor, in case you didn't hear his remarkable interview. There's nothing else that I can do that fits me, that is me. And so when you hear these people, even if they don't say those words, you hear what it sounds like to be in sync, to be what we therapists call congruent. You are yourself. And so I interview these people so that you can hear it, so that you can believe me when I say that there is a person inside of you yearning to breathe free, to quote the Empire, no, the Statue of Liberty, and that if you were to tackle that, if you were to try to go for that. Every piece of yourself that you recover will enhance your life. So today, my interview is with Russell Trays. Russell is a director. And currently, as you will hear, he is directing the very first cabaret performance to appear at the brand new cabaret space at Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. And it is a production of Urban Cowboy, which you will hear him talking about later in the show. And maybe I don't want to say anything else because Russell will say it for himself. So here now is Russell Trays. Okay, I am here with Russ Trays, who is directing Urban Cowboy for Florida Studio Theater, right?
Yes.
Yes. And Urban Cowboy is a cabaret production?
Yes, it's the first cabaret production in their new theater.
Ah, yes, the first cabaret production in the new theater. That's right. Okay, so I don't know, maybe they didn't tell you anything, but I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Okay.
And as a director of a musical piece for the cabaret, I'm assuming that is true of you.
That is true.
Okay. So I only ask one question.
All right.
And that is, how did it start? When was the very first time in your life that you thought music was interesting, that performance was interesting, that you wanted to sing or dance or write? The very first moment.
Well, I always liked music, but the first time that I truly was excited about theater was when I was about 7 or 8 years old. My mother took us to see Where's Charlie with Ray Bolger.
Yeah.
In New York City. We sat in the third balcony, and I don't know whether it was, because I'm scared of heights, and I don't know whether it was the heights or the show, but that was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen, and wonderful. I can to this day see Ray Bolger leaning up against the proscenium and singing Once in Love with Amy.
Yeah.
And then getting the audience to sing along with him, and it was just magic. It was wonderful. So that's what started it.
So you say, I always liked music. Does that mean that you knew even before then that music was something?
Well, I mean, I enjoyed music. I enjoyed singing. I enjoyed, my mom played records on the Victrola.
And you sang along?
And the family had a lot of singing. I grew up in an extended family where we lived right next door to my grandmother and my aunt. My other aunt and her husband lived down the way with their kids. And quite often, after a family meal, which they would have, we would get together on Sundays and then holidays, then the thing would be to sit around in a big circle and my aunt would play the piano and we would all sing. So that was...
Yeah, so it really started for you very, very young. I mean, there was music in the air.
Music
always,
in the air.
Right?
Right?
Okay.
Yeah.
And then at 7 or so, Ray Bolger turns you on. You and the rest of us, I mean, that was extraordinary, Where's Charlie, that production. Yeah. Okay, so you're captured by theater, and what?
Right. So I would, in my small school where I had a class of about 25, I would do various things, in sixth grade I decided that I wanted to do a production about George Washington cutting down the cherry tree, and I wrote it, put it all together. I took boxes from home and brought them in to make columns. I actually went across the street to the Board of Water Supply, who had just recently landscaped, and there was a lovely young tree there that I cut down and brought up. I stuck in a pot and for my cherry tree.
That's really wonderful.
Yeah, and they allowed me to do it while kids were waiting for the school buses. So I
You did this production
just
outside?
All on my own. It was, no, I did it inside.
Inside, but while
in the room.
I see. Well,
because it was a small school, and they didn't have enough buses to go around.
So the kids had to sit and wait.
Wait while the first group went out and got delivered, and then the second group went.
Right.
So I did it for the second
you
group.
You were the entertainment.
I was the entertainment on that one. And
did the Board of Water and whatever worry about
no,
they
it? They never came after me. I don't know. They didn't see me or what.
Oh,
but then
would you have told the truth?
I probably would have. Yes. Yeah, of course.
That's right. Right, of course. Right. Well, wait. This is really interesting. So, but I don't think. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine that in the sixth grade, which is like 12, 13, that suddenly this impulse was full-blown. Were there things that preceded it? I mean, or just suddenly?
I always did little...
Did
I mean, when we had people over for dinner or whatever, they quite often got a little entertained. Of some sort. It was just playing around.
That
was,
right. That was so it. From 7 on, you were playing around.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right around. And in our freshman year in high school, every class had to put on an assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And we put on this one that was, we decided to put it in a bar. the gym also was the, you put chairs in the gym whenever you had assembly.
It was the theater as well.
The theater as well. And I remember that we wanted smoke. So Billy Shelker set off some smoke bombs backstage before the curtain went up, and when it went up, the just a cloud of smoke came through, and it never cleared the whole day. You'd go down big old gym, and there was still smoke.
So the audience is coughing, right?
Yes, right. And it was also that one. I wanted the teasers, the things to go across, the curtains to go across. I wanted them to be lower. So we were there late, and I started getting ready to do this, and I went backstage, and I undid the sandbag
right.
to lower
it. Right.
Well, of course, they're heavy. So
yes.
As soon as I let the sandbag go, it took me up.
Okay.
And so I was like 2 feet off the ground, and this thing was coming down, and there was nobody there, and I was holding on, and Emily Ann came by, Emily Ann Jones, and saw me, and she started to laugh. I started to laugh, and every time I laughed, I went higher and higher. And she finally came and pulled me down, and we got it tied off. And
oh, this is wonderful.
So
you were. So what occurs to me is that in addition to whatever entertaining you were doing, you were also interested in set design.
Oh,
in all of it.
And then when I went to college, had you
decided that some kind of performance career was what you wanted to do, or
no? I decided my junior year in high school that I would be a doctor.
Ah, okay.
I was going to be a doctor so I could make money and go see theater. That was
very
there
clever.
You go.
Very
and
clever.
You go. And again, being in a small town, I did things like working in the hospital
mm-hmm.
during the summer where they let me do things that would
horrifying.
Grow your hair.
Right, right.
And then I went, then when I was in college, I took a creative writing course, which I really enjoyed taking. Sean O'Fallon was teaching it, and basically I could write anything I wanted to and turn it into him once every 2 weeks, and I would go in and we would talk about what I'd written.
Oh, what a wonderful teacher.
It was an amazing experience. And it was a course where they gave you, there was not a mark so that you would not.
It was just pass-fail. Right.
And if there was 2 weeks went by and you didn't feel like doing anything, you could not do it also.
I love this guy.
It was an amazing course for me. But I what happened was I was taking, I wanted to I kept wanting to read plays. So there weren't enough in the English department. So I decided to have a double major of French and English, so I could take the French theater courses that were about the plays. And so I was doing that and pre-med, and by this, the combination proved not good by sophomore year.
Well, it's so much.
Yes,
right?
It was a lot. Yeah. And I got up to organic chemistry, and the man who was teaching organic chemistry thought that if you truly understood your work, you could guess what was in the next chapter. So he would test you on the up on the next chapter.
You're kidding.
And my problem is I was still on the
right.
I hadn't quite gotten up to the thing. So I was two chapters behind instead of one.
Right.
And I had this realization that I didn't, that medicine, I was going to then have to work, think about chemistry, all of that, all the time.
Right.
And I decided, well, instead of making lots of money,
just be in the theater.
And, or just do something that you enjoy. And
nice to be a doctor, but too hard to get there, right?
So eventually that's what I did. And so my senior year, I decided to go into theater, and I applied to Yale, and I had no really thing training, because I was in a school that was a regular
liberal arts college,
mm-hmm. and it was actually Princeton, and I went in one time. I had decided first to go into advertising, and I went into the economics department, asked if I could get a course in marketing and all that, and they said, "Oh no, we don't teach anything practical." So, and that was true in the theater also. You did not have any practical course. There was no acting, no directing, nothing. It was all literature. But subsequently, I had this fabulous background in theater history and the classics. And
because you'd been reading.
Because I'd been reading, not only theater literature, but the classic literature, and getting a great background in both the English and French literature. So I applied to Yale, and they sent me a 10-page questionnaire. I sent them back volumes of things that I'd written. I found out later from my classmates, they'd answered the questions yes and no.
You know, I was curious, and you didn't say, and I didn't ask yet, but in that creative writing class, what were you writing?
I wrote everything. I wrote a poem. I wrote a little short story. I just wrote.
But not a play.
Not a play.
Okay.
No,
I'm
but
just
quite
curious.
Often it was sort of dialogue heavy. But so I went to Yale, and when I was at Yale, there were times when they would give an assignment, and I couldn't find a scene that I wanted, so I would write one. So I did start getting into writing there. But I went as a director, and that's what I loved, and I got a wonderful training there because I went in knowing nothing. So that's where I got my experience.
Right?
A lot of the other people, everyone else, had had acting and all of that in undergrad, and they were repeating it in grad school. But it was all new to me. I was scared to death because everybody else had done and performed and worked on this, and I had not worked on the craft really at all. So it was great training. It was fun.
Yeah, so it was interesting to me. I mean, I would think that, well, I mean, maybe this isn't true, but to some extent those other people had to unlearn some of what they had learned.
I find that working in the field that every school, every teacher has their own theory.
That's the point I'm trying to make.
And, I mean, what you do is you gather theories and then you work with what works for you.
Well, but the point I'm trying to make is that you were essentially tabula rasa. So,
right, yeah.
You know, they must have loved it. I mean, because you were literally soaking up whatever they had to give.
That is
you didn't
correct.
Have anything inside of you saying, no, I don't want that, or I don't do that, or that's not how I do it, or any of that.
That's correct.
Right. So,
but everyone else pretty much was open to learning also. It was a good thing. The scary thing was that we arrived at the opening cocktail party, and I learned at that cocktail party, the day I arrived at Yale, that there were over 20 other students in my first year directing majors. And that the third year only had 8 slots for directors to do a major, their thesis production.
Wow.
Therefore,
yeah,
you were going to be eliminated. And actually, we got down to 6 over the 3 years. Of the 20, over 20 people that arrived thinking they were going to
be directors.
Be directors. They over half, I mean, we were eliminated down to 6.
Do you mean that there were only 6 left by the
That's
third
correct.
Year?
That's correct. At the end of the first year, half the class was told, I'm sorry, you're not coming back.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I had no idea this. When I was a principal, whoever got there graduated.
Right. I understand. You made it to the third year, right?
Right. But then
Well, but apparently
it was a
you
whole
did.
Different thing. Yeah, I did. I did. By my quirk, I got
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, the pressure and the tension.
Yes. Well, you learned how to be able to sort of compliment your fellow people's work enough so that they would still remain friends, but that
right.
then your little right. thing to right. try to keep on top. It was.
Well, it's great training for the profession, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I don't think it is, but.
Oh, yeah. That was a little tongue in cheek, but
yeah,
I mean, because there is the image of the profession.
Because
being.
Actually, for me right now, I mean, people who go to grad school, and I think Yale has changed that policy completely. But it's a wonderful place to get your network of friends,
mm-hmm.
and it really what you need to do is have a very supportive thing. And the 6 of us that did graduate together have remain friends over the years, so it's been
I'm sure nice. It's trial by fire.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you graduate from Yale.
Yeah, and I went and I taught at Interlochen Arts Academy for a year, heading their drama department. And again, when I arrived, the previous year they'd done the all school musical and a staged reading, I think. So I determined that there would be 5 major productions, plus the all-school musical, plus we worked with the drama, with the opera department, and did 7 one-act operas with them.
Wow.
And, because these kids, I had them every day from, I think it was 8 in the morning, I had them for 2 hours every morning from 8 till 10, and then I had them again in the afternoon from 1 to 5.
Oh, my.
Yeah, for production, putting together production. It was class in the morning. And that, so, I mean, that was a rigid schedule, 5 days a week.
Right,
and
right. You had to do something with them.
Right, and 4 hours of production on Saturday. So we had, and then you had dinner with them on Sunday. They were there. I've sort of revved up that drama department, and it did very well during that year. It was a good class, and that department came alive for Interlochen, and they wanted me the next year, and there were now, I'd had 40 kids the first year, and then there were going to be 40 new kids coming in, and I needed another teacher to mm-hmm. help me, and they weren't going to do that. And one of the students' parents came in and said, "We're from Ashtabula, Ohio, and there's a theater there that we have, and we're looking for somebody to help us run that. Do you know of anybody?" Exactly. And the next year I was in Ashtabula, Ohio, running what was really an old vaudeville house. It was a 1,000-seat theater. What I forgot to check was how large Ashtabula was, because it was, the theater seated 1,000, the town was 20,000, which meant that to build the theater you had to have one out of every 20 people.
That's right.
And one out of 100 was more the statistic of people going to theater.
Right.
So I went there, and the training I got there was, again, fabulous, because I was working with the board of directors, and I've noticed in every regional theater, the names change.
Oh, yes.
But they're the same. Names. It's the same cast.
I know.
In there. There's the leading woman who's just, she's the one who's getting it all organized and done. They're the bankers. Yeah. It's just amazing. It's the same board of directors.
Yes, I know.
But this one was a very sincere one and very nice, and we worked well. And my responsibilities were I needed to book in a season of bus and truck companies for a professional season of 5 shows. They were one night each. And it was fun because I was sort of a midway point between like the Eastern Coast and then Detroit and all those people. So they would need a place to stop
on the way.
So they would stop in Ashtabula. And we had the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. We had the Warsaw Chamber Orchestra. I had the Vienna Choir Boys. I had Bus and Trucks of Wait Until Dark and all the Broadway
whatever
shows.
Was going up and down
whatever
was coming
was going
to you.
Up and down. And they, it was, so I learned how to book these things in. There's also a community theater there that was fairly active, and I became part of that and worked with them and directed a lot of their shows. So we had that. And then I established a summer theater there, which they basically had a youth theater in the summer. Then I made it into a non-equity theater where we bought a tent from the cook tent from the circus and set it up in a park down near Lake Erie. And some of my previous students I brought in and hired, and I brought some people in from New York, and we did a summer stock season there.
Lovely.
And I was there for 2.5 years, so we had the 2 seasons of summer stock, and by the second season, we had gotten rid of the circus tent and put up a more permanent pavilion, and which I believe is still used to this day for...
And what were you, about not quite 30?
Yeah, not yet, no.
Mm, right.
And
already you're pretty active and you're making a living in this.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, so I had this going, and I thought, okay, either I'm going to stay here, and what will have to happen is I will have to start not only this theater, I will need to start another couple of theaters so that I could, like, rotate things around and get productions going and get a larger company. But I also wanted to go to New York. Mm-hmm. And so there came a point where I decided, okay, this
you
is
take the leap.
I take the leap. So I went to New York, and it was really the beginning when I went. It was sort of right in the middle of that beginning of Off Broadway with La Mama and Chino and Jackson Poets Theater and all those. And so I went. I had one of my classmates from school was working on Dark Shadows. So he knew some people. He introduced me to an agent who had scripts and things that I got, and I started going to the various theaters and introducing myself. And finally there was a theater that the guy was going to go on vacation, and he hadn't gotten anything in his theater. So he handed me a script. I had taken him a script. He said, "I will forget your script. Look at these 10 scripts. Tell me tomorrow morning, and when before I leave, what one you want to do." So I read through, and I picked out this one that made the most sense to me. Most of them didn't make any sense at all. But I picked this one out, and he went off, and in the next 10 days, I put that together and did the show. Oddly enough, it was back, far enough back, that the person I cast in the leading role, but who got a movie the day after I cast him, was Robert De Niro.
Oh, my goodness.
And then he went off to do...
To
be Robert De Niro. But it was fun. And then the next person I got, the person was Bruce Weitz, who went on to do Hill Street Blues.
Right.
So it was fun. And from that, everybody was inviting agents, so I invited this agent. And she came in, saw the first act, and then sort of fell over me as she was leaving after the first act. And I thought, well,
that's that.
And then she called me and said, "I'd like to be your agent."
Wow.
So I was thrilled. So I sat there for a month waiting for all the calls, which did not come. So I then started to do... I figured... An artist, if they can't afford oils, they do what they've got.
Watercolor,
whatever. Right. So if I'm not doing a big regional theater, what I will do is I will do as many of these showcase things as I can. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And I just, anything anybody would offer me, I would do it. And I did tons of plays, met tons of people, and then... I met the woman who had become my wife, and she knew other people. And eventually, I got my first professional job, which was up at Stage West in Springfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It turned out that it was her teacher from Carnegie had gone up there and was now the artistic director. But I found out that the person who was the business guy there, the head of that, was a guy I had met at a summer camp years before and had become a friend, and I'd lost track of him. And there he was, running the theater. So I got that, and oddly enough, my secretary from Ashtabula, Ohio, mm-hmm. her husband had decided to go to Princeton, to the Divinity School, and that person who was my secretary had become Arthur Lithgow's secretary, and he was running the MacArthur Theater. And every time I did a showcase, she would go, "Arthur, you've got to go see this." Arthur. And he came, he saw it, and so he gave me a job, too. So that I had this...
Lots of synchronicity. Things.
Yeah, lots of synchronicity. Mm-hmm. And, well, John Lithgow, who was Arthur's son, had been in England studying. And when he came back, he had done a showcase for me. One of these, it was his first role in New York. And we became friends. And then Arthur hired me to do Little Murders by Jules Pfeiffer. But then John got his first movie and went off, and he was supposed to do the Scottish play.
Mm-hmm.
And so he turned it over to me. So suddenly I had two productions there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, then they still hadn't chosen the director for Importance of Being Earnest at the end of the season.
And there you were.
And there I was, and I got that. So that's how I got these first four. And then from that, I just went on and
kept working. Well, what's kind of interesting to me is here you're doing Urban Cowboys, which is all music, right?
Mm-hmm.
So far I haven't heard any music in any of this.
Well, I've always been interested in music. In my second year at Yale, that you have two major productions, and everybody was doing very serious little things. And you had to do an original script, and I'd read through all these original scripts that had transformations and all this stuff, and I couldn't stand them. And then I ran across this one that was called Dundor the Dragon. And it was a silly, funny little piece about this guy who's trying to save the girl from the dragon, and it eventually they got to the end, and she kissed the dragon because he had done something, and
he turned into
right. The prince, right. And our charming prince was left alone, but she went off with the dragon.
With the dragon.
And it just amused me, and I thought it was fun, so I did that play, and he was the scene designer. He was not in the playwriting department. So for my thesis production, I decided I wanted to do a musical version of Lysistrata, and that he would write the book and the lyrics, because he loved musicals also the way I did. And the guy who had written incidental music for me, who was from the music school, he would write the music, and that's what we did. He wrote an original musical based on Lysistrata and with music by Peter Schlosser, who was in the music department. And
okay, so how did you wind up here?
How did I wind up here? Okay, I had worked with Jim Helsinger, who's over at Orlando Shakespeare Festival, and actually I worked with them quite a bit, and they wanted to also develop new plays. So one of the actors there wrote a play called Around the World in 80 Days, which I did a reading of and then staged for them. And I believe Jim recommended it to Richard, and that's how Richard found out about it. And so Richard hired me to come down and do that.
And when was that?
That was probably almost 10 years ago now.
So you've done a number of things here.
This is my fourth.
Wow.
So that's how I got here. Richard knew me from that. He hired me again for Measure for Pleasure. And then I came back last year to do The Last Romance.
With David.
Yes, David, whom I adore beyond
me too.
All description.
Me too.
He is a wonderful man.
You should listen to the interview I did with him. It's unbelievable. He's amazing.
He is amazing. He was, I'd tell the story, I mean, he played an 80-year-old man, and he is.
Right.
And he had done the play before at another place, but it had a different version. Mm-hmm. And when we got into rehearsal, David knew his lines, quickly learned his lines. I don't know if he ever used book. He was off book very quickly. All the other actors, all three of the other actors, asked for a line and time upon time. Three times during that time, David would stop and went, nope, that's the old script. And then went back. That was it. I mean, David just, no, and he was there 100%, 200%.
I know.
The entire rehearsal period. I adored that man.
Yeah.
And he just...
And you know, he didn't become an actor until he was over 30. He didn't,
right.
You know. Well, that's his story. So, talk to me about Urban Cowboys. I don't know anything about it. I mean.
Oh, okay. The basis of this is that back in the 70s and the 80s, that there was country music over here and there was popular music over here. But during the 70s and 80s, you started to have people that began to emerge from that crossover. Mm-hmm. And so this is really about those people. It's why it's called Urban Cowboys.
Ah.
It's its own thing. It is taking the country style and turning it into popular music.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, and I've always loved country music, but oddly enough, about 3 or 4 months ago, I started listening to it while I was jogging. People, you know, Garth Brooks, Toby Keith, Dixie Chicks.
I want to tell you something about this. I'd never liked country music, but I was running on my treadmill, and I had a headset that would only get a country station. So I started running to country music, and I fell in love with it.
Yes. Oops, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yes. Brad has all the... Yes, I fell in love with it because, A, lots of times it's energized.
Right.
B, they're great stories.
They're great stories, and sometimes they're very funny.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's it. And there's a simplicity about it that really goes to the heart. They are honest. They're right out there. But they also, some of that lyric writing, which seems so simple, is...
It's very smart.
It's so smart and very, very funny. I mean, the Garth Brooks song, Papa Loves Mama, which we have in here, and Papa Loves Mama, Mama Loved Men, Mama's in the Graveyard, Papa's in the Pen. I mean, it's perfect.
It's perfect.
And he just... They know how to put together the story, make it seem effortless, and yet...
Right.
And you laugh and you cry, what more do you want?
That's right. And what you are is perfectly engaged.
Absolutely.
Right. Oh,
absolutely. Yeah. We have John Denver's Country Roads. Mm-hmm. You put that on, the tear ducts
just open up,
but in a good way, because it comes from joy and from an innocent joy and from... I really need to connect back with your roots, whether they be urban or country. But it is something about this music.
It's a yearning,
And just a frankness of being out there. It's not covered. They've just really...
Yeah, it's guileless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's right.
Right.
So
Richard Hopkins and Rebecca put together the show and asked me if I would be interested in doing it. And I said, yeah. So here I am, and we have a fabulous company.
How many people do you have?
There are five singers. Mm-hmm. And they all play instruments.
Wow.
And so it really comes from that band tradition, which I have also loved. I mean, I developed a show with Harry Chapin, and we used a bluegrass band. Mm. And so this is very similar to that...
story song.
Storytelling, and to that watching Harry and Tom, his brother, work with the band and create the music together and orchestrate it together. It's the same thing that's happening here.
That's lovely. Who's musical director?
His name's Brett Shear. And it works very well with the company. But he's a young man, a composer on his own. He's going to have a musical coming into New York early summer.
So, oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, so I like to ask, having given a life to this work, which you clearly have, is there anything you'd like to say about it?
I have lots.
Well, something.
Yeah. I've I've truly enjoyed my life. I've had a wonderful life. I've done what I really love to do.
Well, that's I think, a great place to stop.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
Come on down and see Urban Cowboy.
You'll have a wonderful time.
I'm sure of it. Thanks, Russ.
I had a wonderful life. I did what I wanted to do. And there in, what, 5 or 6 words is the theme of the Lynn Show. Being the person you were meant to be. And certainly when you listen to Russ, you hear that he is the person he was meant to be. And as always, it is my hope that when you listen to Russ, someone like Russ, you hear that being the person you were meant to be is an option. And perhaps wonder if there's a person that you were meant to be that you are not currently being. And remember, Russ tried to finesse it. He tried to become a doctor so he could afford to indulge his habit, the habit of who he really is. But fortunately for Russ, he figured out very early that he didn't have to do that. He could go right for it. He could be the person he is. Now, it's not that easy for everyone. Remember the Susie don'ts. But it is possible. And, of course, as always, I'm hopeful that in listening to Russ, you may be encouraged to wonder what it might be that you are in denial for or cheated out of. I want to tell you that next week I'm playing an interview I did with David Howard. And you heard Russ talk about David in this interview. David is a very, very special guy. And I'm rebroadcasting an interview that I did a while back. I'm going to talk about what David is doing these days. So I hope that you'll come back for that, because listening to David is really remarkable. And not only that, but a treat. So, before I close, I need to do, as always, thank Josh Hackney, who just never fails to come up with whatever it is I need to solve, whatever problem I have, as I like to say, with anything that has a plug or a battery. And if you need anything, computer, recording, electronics, iPhone, iPad, it doesn't matter, you want Josh. And you can get him the way you can get me, by going up on my website, thelinshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You'll get a different Lynn. And click on email me and say, I need to talk to Josh, or I want to talk to you, or anything else you'd like to say. And as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. Something that has power for you. At the very least, something that brings you back, because next week, as I said, will be a treat. I will be here with David Howard, and we will hope that you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.